Okay, why don't we let's fire up again here. I know, it's kind of hard to... Okay, anything preliminary here? Then let's talk about Vanderpool. Maybe somebody's been inspired over the break to take this one on. Ms. Sharp. Okay, let's just pause for a moment. There's a puzzling feature of this case, which is that one employee is suing, in effect, another employee, and it, particularly if you've read all the way to the end of the chapter and you have workers' comp working through your mind here, you think, well, why isn't this claim covered by workers' comp? And I'm not sure I have an answer to that question, but for whatever reason, nobody seems to think there's a problem with workers' comp. Instead, the problem is that this is a claim, for our purposes, she might just as well be a private a visitor to the museum. Okay, so she's suing the state of Oklahoma for the negligence of one of the state's employees, and what's the state's answer to her claim? She's suing the state claiming they were negligent, and the state responds to her claim by saying what? Yeah, you can't touch us. We are immune. Now, this in turn provokes the court into a sort of historical reverie here, not unlike the discussion we had in Laird versus Nelms, but as particularly applied to the state of Oklahoma. And if you want to sort of see this conceptually, as we've done before, you have a general principle like sovereign immunity, but then you have a series of exceptions to that. It's not as though no one has ever been able to recover for tortious conduct by a state agent. There have been such cases in the past. And what are those? Okay, the first was to say the state's sovereign immunity doesn't apply to proprietary functions. And we haven't really talked about that up until now. What's a proprietary function? If you are the proprietor of a business, you are the owner of that business, you are essentially engaged in, well, we sometimes also refer to proprietary information, sort of belonging to the business. A proprietary function is essentially a business function. As distinguished, what would be the antonym from the opposite? If it's not proprietary, it's, what's that? Well, yeah, that's a any port in a storm, as they say. But what would be something that the government does that wouldn't fall within that proprietary? It's the label we get. Okay, what does the government do that they don't make a profit on? Most of the stuff they do, we would refer to those as, this would be versus governmental functions. So hopefully when the government operates a police force, they're not doing it on a profit basis. They do this, they collect taxes and they hire a police force and they enforce the laws, and there's no money to be made in that. Whereas if the state, for example, operates a boat rental at their state park, or they have a campground where they charge you fees to use different kinds of, or they have a little store where you can buy, you know, marshmallows to roast on your campfire. If they're making money in these proprietary functions, probably the largest proprietary function that most states engage in is providing medical care. So that at a state hospital, you know, at the University of Washington's University Hospital, you know, I don't know what their annual budget is, but it's, I'm sure, in the hundreds of millions of dollars, which they collect from private insurance companies and other sources. So if it's a proprietary function, sovereign immunity doesn't apply. Why? What's the rationale for that? Mr. Glover? Yeah, whether they show a profit in a particular year is less relevant than the fact that they can charge you for, you know, buying a book in the historical, you know, they've got a little gift shop at the historical museum or the, you know, state art gallery or something, or you go to the state capitol and they've got a little place where you can buy postcards and you can buy a cup of coffee, and this is operated by state, you know, it's a state employee that's working there selling you a hamburger and whatever. Hopefully not. Again, the collection of taxes or the imposition of criminal fines isn't operated like a business. At least, again, we hope not. It's not that somebody sits down. But again, the notion is that to the extent that the government is imitating private entities, they ought to be treated like private entities. But to the extent the government is doing things unique to government, again, it's sort of the idea of, what would we do with a private citizen operating supersonic military jets? Well, wait a minute, private citizens don't operate, you know, supersonic military jets. Whereas we do have the case of, what happens if a business owner left, you know, a hole in the floor or left, you know, a rip in the carpet that caused somebody to trip and fall down? Well, somebody would have to pay for that. So proprietary functions were excluded from the immunity. People had recovered damages from the operation of proprietary functions. Another rationale for excluding that from sovereign immunity was the notion that the government could give that up. You know, if they found it too expensive to pay the tort damages and put up with the liability from operating a boat rental, they could stop renting boats. But they can't stop having a police force or building roads for us or operating bridges. We can't get along without those functions. The governmental functions are essential. The proprietary functions are sort of optional. So again, the courts felt as though the principle of sovereign immunity didn't extend to proprietary functions. What other areas had been excluded from the immunity, or again, the sort of double negative, had the courts allowed the government to be held liable? Anything else beyond proprietary functions? What's that? Where there was already insurance in place. So if, for example, a state employee travels across the state, you know, flies from one part of the state to another and gets in a, rents a car, and the car is covered by insurance, well, so long as it's not the government that's paying for it, we're happy to impose liability on the government where it's not coming out of the government's pocket. So there had been liability for that. There were also some statutory exceptions for what do they call it? Governmental subdivisions or What do you call them? Political subdivisions, counties, cities, et cetera. That is, short of the state itself, counties and municipalities had been subject to tort liability. It's just the state itself, like this particular defendant, that maintained its immunity. Now, the plaintiff has an argument as to why this pattern or this sort of principle ought to be set aside in favor of a broader waiver of immunity. What's the plaintiff's argument? Or maybe to put it the other way around, what does the defendant, the state, claim is the reason that the court should say no to Mrs. Vanderpool? Anybody have a sense of what, if you're the government in this case, the state of Oklahoma, plaintiff's trying to, in effect, adopt a new rule, setting aside this principle of sovereign immunity and replacing it with a rule that's sort of like the Federal Tort Claims Act. If you're the government, what would you tell the court? Mr. Lynch? Okay, but before we get to the merits of it, there's a sort of procedural issue. Mr. Cleveland? Yeah, you can't do that. I mean, the Federal Tort Claims Act, after all, wasn't adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court. It was adopted by the United States Congress. This is the function of the legislature. You know, you came to the building, you know, you want to be down the street, you know, a couple of blocks here. That's where you find the legislature. Here we are in the court, and the court can only sort of apply the law that it's been given. What's the plaintiff's argument in response to this claim that the court lacks the power to adopt a new rule here, that only the legislature could waive sovereign immunity? Turns out to be a successful argument. Ms. Peterson? Not really, because that would be true if it were a county employee or a city employee, but here it's an employee of the state government itself, for which the legislature had not. I mean, again, one of the government's arguments, the defendant's argument, is the legislature hasn't ignored this. The legislature, it's sort of like you're the parent of four children, and you say, you know, Johnny, Susie, and Bill may go to the park. You know, Michael, the youngest, gets the message that, you know, while Mom didn't say explicitly, Michael may not go to the park, when she says, you know, these three may go, it seems the implicated, sort of what they call the negative pregnant here, it appears that the implication is that rule does not apply to Michael. Did she ever say explicitly, Michael may not go to the park? But no, if that's what she had in mind, why didn't she throw that in at the same time? So when the legislature says political subdivisions, the people further down on the political food chain, they are subject to liability and remain silent with respect to state officers and state agencies, it sounds like the legislature didn't want this immunity to be removed. But the plaintiff has an argument here to the effect that, Mr. Lobach? You're just scratching your nose. Yeah, okay. Ms. Sharp? And who dreamed this up? Who dreamed up governmental immunity? Yeah, but what part of the government? The courts did. Actually, because remember, the way we got this is that when litigants first started trying to nail the government, the courts said, oh, you can't do that. So it was a principle of common law rather than the legislature. If the legislature had passed a statute that said, we hereby adopt sovereign immunity, it'd be pretty tough for the plaintiff to argue, well, you can change that. The one principle we seem to have that courts have to abide by is if the legislature gives you an explicit command, you've got to follow it. But again, if the legislature has said, in effect, you know, Johnny, Susie, and Bill may go to the park but said nothing about Michael, the courts think, well, gee, to the extent that you left that open, we're still free to do what we think is the right thing. Okay, so the court initially, somewhat controversially, claims for itself the right to reshape the rule with respect to sovereign immunity, that the floor is now open within the court to decide how to structure, you know, what, where to retain immunity and where to decide, well, this rule no longer makes sense for modern society. Again, we keep coming back to this theme of judges looking at a body of law that has arguably failed to serve the present needs of society. And at what point does the court say, time makes ancient good uncouth, and we're going to abandon that and replace it with a more modern rule? And at what point does the court say, gee, I agree with you on the merits of this, but after all, we're just judges. Go down the street and talk to the legislature. Here, the court says, this was our mistake, and we're now going to correct our mistake. We used to think that sovereign immunity was a universal rule, but look at what's happened across the country. Most jurisdictions have abandoned sovereign immunity and have provided for a waiver, and we're going to do the same. And what's that going to look like? Yes. And what do those exceptions look like? Okay, and notice the way they phrased that with respect to legislative and judicial functions, there's absolute immunity. No matter how nutty a legislature's or judge's court's activity, you can't base a tort claim on that. However, with respect to administrative functioning, you can make a claim so long as you're not attacking a determination of fundamental governmental policy. Notice that this is a little bit narrower of an exception. The simply talking about a discretionary function of the Federal Tort Claims Act requires the judiciary to draw a line between operational and policy making. But here they're saying the immunity is only retained with respect to determining fundamental governmental policy. So whether to change over from snow tires to summer tires, or whether to build a, you know, whether to repave that road to eliminate the bumps in it, and that kind of stuff could hardly be called fundamental governmental policy, although it might in fact be governmental policy. Whether to replace that buoy out in the Georges Bank is not a fundamental governmental policy. But so again, the way this is phrased would give the plaintiff some encouragement in a case where we're trying to find the boundary line between what's permitted and what's not. But there's another interesting thing that the court does in applying this new rule. So they give you, in effect, a kind of statute, and again, for those who are troubled by the court's exercise of this sort of authority, it sure looks like the court is legislating from the bench here, but the court, in recognition of the fact that it's kind of getting a little frisky here, says, wait a minute, we've got something to sort of soften the blow here. What are they going to do? What's that? They are or are not going to apply it retroactive. No, actually, they're not. So the rule applies, and this turns out to be an interesting issue in other areas, constitutional areas, of when you apply principles retroactively and when you apply them prospectively only. So, for example, if you adopt a rule of evidence that says, you know, certain kinds of evidence may be admitted or may be excluded, to what kinds of cases does that apply? Any case that hasn't yet gone to trial, from the day you have that new opinion as to what's admissible and what's not, trial courts will begin putting that online. What about decisions that some kind of conduct will or will not be subjected to tort liability? Typically, that's applied to cases that haven't yet gone to trial. We see that, for example, in the comparative fault cases in the next chapter. But in this case, they say we only want this rule to apply prospectively. So if you go back and look at sort of a timeline here, Mrs. Vanderpool gets injured in 1978, something like that. I don't know if they give you a date as to when she gets injured. Anybody have their finger on that? Let's just speculate here that she gets injured in 1978. By the time she goes to a lawyer and they bring it to trial and the trial court dismisses it and they appeal it and they get it up to the Supreme Court and they argue it and the court issues its opinion, it's 1983. When do people injured by the negligence of state employees have the right to sue under this new rule? When does this kick in? No, not even 1983. Ms. Russell? 1985. So as of October 1, 1985, people injured by the negligence of a state employee may sue and recover for their injuries. If you get hit by a state employee in an intersection in 1984, a year after this decision has come down, you wouldn't get a remedy for that. They would say the principle of sovereign immunity still applies. This old rule they recognize needs to be replaced, won't be replaced for another 2 years. Kind of an odd little provision here. Why are they doing that? Mr. Nelson?
Agencies time to get their ducks in a row.
In what ducks need to be gotten in a row here? Okay, up until now, in effect, what we've told the state is don't worry about being negligent, and in particular, don't worry about buying insurance. I mean, in sort of a perverse way, they said if you had bought insurance before, that would make you liable, where if you didn't have insurance, you wouldn't. So it's sort of no good deed goes unpunished principle. But now we're saying, as of October 1, 1985, you better make sure that these state agencies have insurance coverage because any torts they commit will be subject to liability. And in addition, review your policies and procedures. There may be things you got used to doing in the era when no one could sue you for your negligence, but now that you can be sued for your negligence, you should probably take a look at those areas that would get you in trouble. Now start behaving like private companies who worry about these things. Okay, so the era of liability is going to begin October 1, 1985, with one exception. Mrs. Vanderpool, injured back in 1978, 7 years before the effective date of this new regime, she gets to recover. Why? Mr. Jones? Yeah, she gets sort of a commission on this. She gets a finder's fee. If you're going to go to all the trouble, and you know, it's sort of an interesting little, we sort of talked about imagining yourself in the place of the parties or the lawyers involved. you're the lawyer sitting in your office in wherever it is, in Oklahoma City or someplace in Oklahoma, and Mrs. Vanderpool walks in and tells you, hey, I've got these injuries from a state employee, and you refresh your understanding of the law, go read something, the latest case, and you say, well, gee, you know, your claim is barred by sovereign immunity. However, I don't like that rule. Lots of people have criticized it. Maybe, just maybe, the Supreme Court will decide that the principle of sovereign immunity is out of date and needs to be replaced. Under what circumstances would you, as a lawyer, take such a case? I think if your only object was to make some money, the thought that you would prevail and persuade the court in a landmark decision to change the law, the chances of that are not real good. But this is great fun. And it could be good for business in the long run that you're known as the lawyer that, you know, brought this case, et cetera, et cetera. And indeed, the court recognizes that, not just, you know, patting the lawyer on the head and saying, good job, I'm glad you brought this to our attention. Sorry we can't help you. The court does, in fact, say this rule applies to you. It's not going to break the bank. And after all, we recognize that you deserve to recover. As to these other people out here, similarly situated to you, but prior to the effective date of this law, we're going to leave them no worse off than if we didn't decide this case, but if we had to include them, we might not be ready to rule in your favor. Again, it's an interest. We had actually a speaker last year, a faculty candidate, who addressed this issue. As it turns out, I believe this candidate decided to take another job someplace, in any event, didn't get hired. But when he made his presentation, it was about this whole issue of prospectivity and retroactivity. He made an argument about, when you should and shouldn't, again, remember the details of it. But in any event, this whole question about courts looking at changing the rules and how they do it in a way that's both just to the people who are in front of them, but also just with respect to people that have gone before them or will follow them, et cetera. Okay, so again, what we're going to keep stirring the pot here with respect to the function of courts in ruling on disputed issues with respect to the status of common law principles, how they interact with legislatures who also play on this field. That's another thing I meant to mention with respect to the reason they postponed it until October 1, 1985. They hold open the distinct possibility we've read the legislature wrong. They care passionately about this. They care enough about it that they're going to pass a statute that says we hereby retain the rule of sovereign immunity, in which case we say, never mind. Finally, the legislature has spoken. I heard Mom say that Johnny and Susie and Billy can go to the park. I didn't hear her say anything about Michael. If she says, oh yeah, and Michael can't, well, that settles that. But as long as she's silent about that, there's still the possibility that, well, you know, it's not like she said we couldn't do it. So if the legislature has never said anything about the sovereign immunity of the state, it's still an open question. Obviously, though, we want to, again, the court's trying to be deferential here, not as deferential as some would like it to be, but it's trying not to be a bull in a china shop here and just trampling over things where it has no business. Okay. Questions about Vanderpool or about sovereign immunity in general? Again, you want to simply pay close attention to the statutes. The statutes will often contain provisions that place some kind of special limits on recoveries against the state, so that they will say you can only recover this much in terms of the total damages, or it will be restricted in terms of economic damages versus non-economic damages. The state's free to set the parameters under which it's going to have to pay out, and so you want to take a look at that. Mr. Cleveland? The date of the injury. So claims arising, that is, the date when the claim is essentially born, the date you get hit in an intersection collision is the day the claim, the cause of action for your injuries arises, that has to be after October 1, 1985 to fall within this rule. So again, it's a really odd kind of disposition. Most of the time when a court recognizes we need to change the law, for example in Rodriguez, we now recognize claims for loss of consortium. We're saying that anything that is still timely, you're welcome to bring. They don't force people to wait until some future date before they can exercise their rights. Ms. Russell. What's that? Yes, with respect, again, the way the Supreme Court in Laird versus Nelms, the way they read the congressional statute was, Congress wanted to remove its immunity, to waive its immunity with respect to negligent or other wrongful things like intentional torts. But it didn't want to go so far as to remove its immunity for claims that are based on a strict liability theory. If the government wasn't negligent, the government shouldn't have to pay for those injuries. That's the way the Supreme Court interpreted this kind of ambiguous language in the Federal Tort Claims Act. And Laird versus Nelms is actually a very good exercise in seeing the way in which the people who wrote the Federal Tort Claims Act were not, you know, asleep at the switch or dummies or anything. But the best laid plans, as they say, create ambiguities people hadn't thought about. Virtually every statute has these little sort of anomalies. Well, you know, do you really mean this? Sometimes you have something very clear. Arnold Schwarzenegger cannot be the President of the United States under the current Constitution. That's one thing that's very clear. You have to be a native-born American citizen to be President of the United States. You could change that by constitutional amendment, but that one, bingo, is clear. Lots of other things. What does it mean to be an establishment of religion? What does freedom of the speech, you know, what does freedom of speech mean relative to child pornography on the internet? You know, when you get to that stuff, the meaning of the Constitution, particularly in light of what did the framers of the First Amendment intend with respect to the Internet? You know, that's a pretty difficult question to ask there. So lots of times, courts interpreting statutes, wrongful death statutes or whatever else, sovereign immunity statutes, they're stuck with something that's got a lot of gray areas. It's not sharply clear black and white that oh yeah, this qualifies, this doesn't. So again, the other thing you want to do as you sort of look at statutes with the eye of thinking, well, what would a court do with it, would be to think courts are, as we've seen in lots of other cases like the Iowa case, Schoenberger versus Roberts, courts try to make sense of these things. If they've got some leeway, they're going to pick the interpretation that to them has the best kind of policy outcome. They're not going to override a clear statute and replace it with a better policy if the legislature's clear, but where the legislature's given them some rope to play with, they're going to do what they can to make it turn out in a reasonably sensible way. And again, this whole question about how judges are supposed to interpret such things as the Constitution, other than whether Arnold Schwarzenegger can be president, most other things are matters of fiercely controversial issues about how do we go about interpreting this document. What does it mean? How do we reconcile text, social policy, changes in society, etc.? Okay. Any other questions about Vanderpool before we move on to parents? Okay, let's talk about Holoduc then. Anybody want to tell us about the Holoduc infant, as they say? I don't think he's ever given a name here. Going once, going twice. Ms. Russell reluctantly raised her hand there. Will anybody come to her rescue, or you're going to have to fight the fight alone here? Okay, go at it. Okay, let's just diagram this thing for a moment here. You've got the kid, the child who runs out into the street between these parked cars, and you've got the defendant driving down the street, striking the child. The parents over here are claiming the medical expenses, but sort of suing on his behalf. But it's basically the child is suing the defendant. But now the defendant wants to recover from the parents, saying, if I'm held liable in this thing, my liability should be limited by the extent to which it was the parents' fault that he was out there in the first place. What's the parents' response to the claim that they are answerable to the driver in this case? When the defendant says, when the driver says, hey parents, you got to pony up your share of it, the parents say, we're immune, right? You can't touch us. We're the parents after all. Okay, so they're claiming parental immunity. And the defendant, the driver, has an answer to that. Oh, no, you're not immune. By what authority does the driver say that immunity doesn't apply to this case? Sorry, is that a little louder there? Yeah, in the Gelbman case, what happened? Okay, so, but what were the facts of Gelbman? Does it say there someplace?
I kind of inferred them, but basically, parents were only 2 weeks of an actual between the parties still weren't
accountable. And I don't know whether it says this in the opinion or not, but Gelbman involved an automobile accident. Child was a passenger in a car being driven by dad. Child sues dad. And instead of saying, oh, children can't sue their parents, parents are immune, the court said, no, dad is liable to Junior because Junior was the victim of dad's negligence. That's Gelbman. Does that apply to this case? The driver says Gelbman removed parental immunity, and therefore, it's fair game for me to say, parent, you did a bad job supervising your child. They say that Geldman doesn't apply, but it's not because in this case there's a third party involved. Although that is a difference. Ms. Jones? Explain that to me. Why is Geldman different? You're right, but just explain it to me. Geldman involved, you say, a general duty? Okay, so the basis of the claim in Geldman is you're a bad driver. Oh, you happen to be parent and child? Oh, well, we're not going to pay any attention to that. In this case, you can't do that. You can't say this adult sat by doing nothing while this child darted out in front of the car. Oh, you happen to be parent and child? Well, we don't care about that. It's because they're parent and child that we care. That's the source of the duty. And they say, therefore, while we allowed suits between children and parents, if there were a duty other than the family relationship, but where you base it on the family relationship, you're back in our wheelhouse here on parental immunity. The way I distinguish this, if Susan handed out, if these little charts here have, I don't know if they have chapter 4 here. Yeah. Is there liability to a child? I say on the outline, yes, for bad driving, but there's no liability for bad parenting. So where a child is injured by that child's parents' negligence, you have to figure out, in order to resolve the immunity question, is the parent immune from a claim for negligence? You have to say, is this a claim that relies on the parent-child relationship? Is it a bad parenting claim? If so, immunity applies. But if it's not based on the parent-child relationship, then it's vulnerable to suit. There's no immunity for that. You can imagine cases in which the line is hard to draw. Suppose Dad and Junior go out hunting, and Dad gives Junior a rifle that's too, or a shotgun that's too big for him. And Junior tries to use this shotgun, but it kicks back or it does something else. It causes him an injury, and Junior wants to sue Dad. Are we suing him because he's a bad dad? Or are we suing him because he's a bad hunter? I think you can make an argument either way, depending on exactly the facts of the case. So, but again, at least you'd recognize the legal principle, which I can articulate on an exam, should the occasion arise. I can say, oh, well, to the extent that this is based on a bad parenting claim, it's immune. But to the extent that this duty would be owed regardless of what your relationship is, if you take somebody hunting, an inexperienced person, and you give them equipment that's ill-suited to them and they get injured, well, that's a failure to use reasonable care with, you know, a firearm. Oh, they happen to be parent and child? Well, I don't care about that. If that's the case, then no immunity applies. But if I'm relying on the parent-child relationship to create the duty, because this is the parent of the child, they have a duty to watch out for them, then we've got concerns about immunity. At the risk of confusing you, there is a similarity here between what we do in the policy-making governmental function of sovereign immunity and what we do by saying that parents, in the exercise of their policy making as parents, enjoy a kind of immunity. So if a 15-year-old is out rock climbing and gets hurt, and that 15-year-old sues the manufacturer of the equipment or sues the, you know, whatever it is, there's some third party, and the third party says, ah, but the parents shouldn't have let that 15-year-old go out rock climbing, it's too dangerous. Bad judgment by the parents. Society says, you know, with respect to that, parenting judgments, how to raise a 15-year-old, we don't want to try to second guess the kinds of decisions parents have to make. Should you let your child play in the front yard even though they might run out in front of parked cars to retrieve a ball? Some parents would say that's an irresponsible thing to do. Other parents would say, you know, if you don't give the kid a little, you know, room to run around, if you try to control everything, they're going to turn into mixed-up kids later on. Mr. Bradford. Okay. There's a standard below negligence, a little bit like, you know, when we talked in the punitive damages area. There's parental negligence. I make a bad decision. I let my 15-year-old stay out with her boyfriend, you know, and they get into big trouble. And people would say, hey, DeWolf, what kind of a parent are you? That was really stupid. But there's a difference between that sort of negligence, again, where we say, all of us in this room might agree that that's negligent, but parents still have the authority to decide how they're going to raise their 15-year-old. There's a difference between that and the kind of irresponsible parenting. I leave my 8-year-old and my 5-year-old alone at home for the weekend while we go off to Cuernavaca. And I, you know, show them where the cereal and milk is, and give them the number of our hotel in Cuernavaca and say we'll be home, in, you know, Sunday night, the state will come and take my kids away. That's a standard. If I fall, it's not an area where, gee, you know, your kids they're going to have a lot of problems later in life because you're just making really poor parenting decisions, versus saying, you are such a bad parent, we're going to take your kids away. You have to be pretty bad to get to that bottom level. And, of course, that whole question, the controversy about how much authority Child Protective Services or other state agencies should have, whether they're too lax or too prone to intervene. You know, you can hear nightmare stories either way about people whose kids were taken away because of some, you know, crazy person that thought they were not doing the way that parent would want things to be done. I have an interesting story along those lines, but we don't have time for it today. But again, that whole question is one. Now, the thing I do want to cover before we run out of time today is a different kind of claim. The one we've been talking about up till now is where the child is the injured party, and the child has a potential claim against the parent. And the dividing line we use is, if you're complaining about bad parenting, you're stuck. Child has no claim. Neither does anybody else trying to make the parents contribute. On the other hand, to the extent that it's not a parenting function, the parent is not immune. There's a different kind of claim I want to talk about, which is where the child is the perpetrator and somebody else is the injured party. I have a 4-year-old who likes to set fires. I don't exercise appropriate care. My child goes out and lights my neighbor's house on fire. Can that neighbor sue me as a parent for the injury caused by my child? Not an injury to my child, an injury caused by my child. And the principle is this. If the parent, and here again at the risk of confusing you, because there are differences, but there's a certain parallelism here to Chapter 1 on wild animals. not strict liability, I want to be clear about that, but the idea is of notice. If the parent is on notice of a propensity, my child has issues with fire, my child has issues with, you know, likes to find cars parked on a hill, release the emergency brake, see how far they go before they stop. You know, if my child has some, you know, likes to play with fireworks or something else, I know about this propensity, I'm then under an obligation to use reasonable care to restrain them. It's actually more, I mean, part of the concern is with, you know, a four-year-old, six-year-old, kind of before they reach the age of you know, some quasi-rationality. And you can have these, you know, real horrible behavioral problems. You can also have problems with the adolescent whose, you know, hormones are surging and is doing all kinds of wild and crazy things. Again, the parent is not strictly liable. There's no vicarious liability here. But a parent has a duty to use reasonable care. If my 13-year-old has gone off and lit a fire at the school, set a trash can on fire, or my 13-year-old has a fascination with guns and goes off and looks for them and, you know, so forth, I have a duty to use reasonable care, take the kid to counseling, but I don't have a duty to lock the kid away. If the kid is otherwise at liberty to go to school and stuff, the kid goes to school, on their way home, they set another fire. I, as a parent, am not vicariously liable, only if I fail to use reasonable care. Did I hear about this problem and then blow it off? Did I fail to take my kid to counseling? Did I fail to, you know, okay, then I have a potential liability. But again, but I want to make sure you're clear in distinguishing the kind of harm. Not a harm to the child, but a harm caused by the child. In that case, it is a liability based upon a known propensity. Not just I've got a kid with issues, mad about the fact that, you know, his mother left when he was 5 years old and he's got some, you know, side effects from that. But I know he has a propensity to do a specific thing, light fires, shoot guns, et cetera. Then if that recurs and I fail to use reasonable care to address it, I can be held liable. Questions about parental immunity, Mr. Nelson?
So your kid, you know, he lights fires. On the way home, he lights fire to a house. You've already taken reasonable care. Who can the homeowner look to recover from it?
Not the parents. Yeah, yeah. Again, the idea, because remember, this is in the area of policy, as all of these immunities grew out of a policy sense, that the idea that parents can be held liable for what their children do, as a society we recognize that at a certain point there's only so much a parent can do. And the fact that my kid is a bad kid shouldn't necessarily be visited upon me unless I've fallen below some standard that society has set. Why don't we pick up with that on Monday. We'll obviously finish immunities and then go right into Chapter 5.